Welcome back to another episode of our Clean Sailors podcast. I'm your host, Holly, founder of Clean Sailors. Let's get started. Hi, I'm really excited today to be joined by Sam Stewart, founder of Relief Crew Foundation, connecting skilled yacht crew with humanitarian projects and environmental projects around the world. Sam, thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, Holly. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me along.
I'm really looking forward to this one, Sam, because, well, it's really incredible. But firstly, just tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is that you've actually created.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Sam. I'm from New Zealand. I'm the founder of Relief Crew Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization connecting yacht crew with humanitarian projects around the world. In a nutshell, we find projects that need volunteers with a certain skill set, and then we find crew that are looking for projects with a purpose on their time off. We match them together, we put a team of volunteers together, and we go off and we work on a volunteering project.
What kind of projects are you talking about? I mean, don't be shy, because this is almost the exceptional part of it. We are talking about real life humanitarian environmental projects around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the last one we did, we were in Ghana, in a small village in the north. We spent 3 weeks there building toilets in a community that had no access to sanitation. So we were working alongside the people in the village, and we built 51 toilets in 17 days, which was one toilet for each household in the village. So that was the last one. We've got one coming up, which is more of a vocational training kind of project. So we're going to Greece in a few weeks, and we're connecting with a refugee camp in Greece, where Greece has got a situation in that there's a massive shortage of workers in the hospitality and tourism sectors. And then you've got, you know, a large pool of people that have been forced to flee their homes and are now trying to start afresh in this part of the world. And they're looking for, looking for job opportunities once they've got their refugee status. And we're taking a team of interior crew to set up this training center, which will basically use the skills that interior use every day on yachts. So we'll be teaching things like service, housekeeping, barista training, kitchen prep, all these different skills that people can use then to crack into that service industry.
It's fantastic, because it's two worlds, crudely, it's two worlds that seem so just polar opposites of each other, right? We've obviously very familiar with boating, but otherwise we're talking about the sort of the high-risk galleons of society and sort of luxury super yachting, hey, and obviously also the exceptional skills of the individuals that work within that industry, being able to sort of transcend yachting and actually be able to deliver those skills into communities that need them. How did you get into yachting yourself? What's your background there?
So I started in yachting maybe 13 years ago. So I'm a journalist by trade. So studied journalism. And then when I graduated university, I was writing for a boating magazine in New Zealand. And I spent 4 years doing that, with the goal always being to get overseas and explore. And at one point I had a good friend who had been working on yachts for a summer call me and say, "Hey, Sam, you know, I think you're really going to enjoy this." And it was kind of on his word that I quit my job and sold my car and booked a one-way ticket to Palma, Mallorca. And that was the start of it. I spent the summer day working there and just, you know, absolutely loved being in that part of the world and exploring this new industry. And it sort of unfolded from there.
And what were some of the highs? I mean, obviously the travel and an innate sense of kind of getting out and seeing the world a little bit. What were some of the actual lows about that experience too? Appreciating that obviously boating is a very specific industry. It's a lifestyle more than it is a job. So what were some of the absolute highs, but also the toughest things about being in yachting?
Good question. Absolute highs. I mean, yeah, I mean, the primary reason to enter the industry for me was the travel side of things. And, you know, I've had a very close connection with boating before that. So the first yacht that I got on was this old, it was a 50 meter tugboat, this converted tug. And I actually joined it in Australia, in Cairns, Australia. So I ended up flying from Mallorca, where I'd, you know, spent this glorious summer exploring European lifestyle and that sort of thing, and ended up back in Australia thinking maybe I've gone backwards here. But we soon set off and we're exploring the top of Australia into Malaysia through Indonesia. And I think looking back, that was you know, those days were some of the best on yachts for sure, because you know, I was green in that space. So every day was just learning. There's not a huge amount of responsibility other than the job that you have directly in front of you when you're a green deckhand. And we were in the most incredible places, you know, these spots in Indonesia that you could only get to by boat. And so I think those were definitely the highs. You know, at one point we had guests on and they'd been on for a couple of weeks. And at the end of it, we dropped them off and they said, hey, you need to experience what we just did. So take the boat and spend a week wherever you want in this archipelago and treat it as if it's yours. And yeah, we just had this week where we were, you know, living it up and, you know, getting up every morning and swimming, diving, sailing, wakeboarding. And yeah, and the kind of experiences that very fortunate to have in that regard. So those were definitely highs. Lows, I think, well, it's that kind of double-edged sword, you know, being from New Zealand, I always wanted to explore the rest of the world and get out and see what else exists. But doing that, I missed a lot of things back home as well. You know, it's not so easy to jump back on a flight and get home. So I think for me, you know, the lows from yachting probably came from what I missed out on in terms of weddings and family holidays and, you know, being there when nieces and nephews are getting older and having birthdays and that sort of thing. So yeah, that would be the lows, rather than actually terrible situations on board or things going wrong, which of course inevitably happen in the yachting industry. But those are things that can pass, you know, like, and I also quite like it when things go wrong on a boat, because it's like, all right, let's fix this. Let's see how we can get out of this. Yeah. So it was more what was missed out on back home during that period.
It sounds like you're the kind of person to have around in a crisis, Sam, if there's a situation. Yeah. Sounds like you thrive in them. But I can see, obviously, it's an incredible, incredible industry to work in. It's just the luxury of spending time on the water for any seafarer or, you know, boater, whatever sector of the industry is being served whilst doing it. It's a really unparalleled experience having that as your professional playground, also for, you know, sort of your passion and your hobby alongside it. So it does sound incredible. What then on that basis, Sam, made you, or what sort of moments were building up ultimately to you leaving that and setting up at the foundation?
I think, well, there was one moment in particular that I really think set a course for what I'm doing now with this nonprofit. And I was on a yacht in Italy and we pulled into port in the south of Italy. And as we were coming in, we had guests on the back of the boat having lunch. I was on the stern getting the lines ready to tie up. And we passed a Coast Guard boat that was already tied up to the dock. And it was full of asylum seekers, like just absolutely rammed. You've never seen so many people packed onto a boat. And they had just been rescued from somewhere in the Mediterranean. And coming in on this, you know, luxurious yacht and seeing this boat full of people that had obviously been forced to flee their home, running from, you know, I don't know what it was, whether it was war or persecution or whatever their individual stories were, but they were in a position where they, you know, had to get out. And seeing this juxtaposition, like in such close proximity, it felt like I'd be punched in the heart, to be honest, like seeing this and realizing how fortunate I was to even be working on a boat, you know, let alone the people that were having lunch on the back of it kind of thing. And from there, I made the decision that, okay, I want to be working on something that is helping people, essentially helping people that genuinely need it. So that was kind of the catalyst for that. And then I started looking into specifically refugees. Where can I lend a hand in this space? And ultimately that took me to having a summer off. So I resigned from a yacht and I spent the summer volunteering in a refugee camp in Greece. It was very clear from day one that the skills yacht crew have are transferable into this humanitarian environment. And that was essentially, you know, I didn't know it at that time, but that was the catalyst for what has become Relief Crew Foundation now.
That's incredible. Actually, because my question was going to be to you, why then set up your own? But obviously it's evident you're experiencing the environments where, you know, help and specific skills are required and seeing the, you know, I really mean it. Like, there's exceptional skill sets in the boating and marine industry because of what you described about things going wrong. It's an environment where things can go wrong. The loading is incredible. Whatever vessel you're on, the engineering, the design, the construction, the hospitality and the service element, as you pointed out. So it's really, really rich in that sense. So actually, you being in the environment of working with, say, refugees and seeing what the gaps are in supporting that process gave you the sort of catalyst to combine the two together. I mean, it sounds so obvious in one level now that you've done it, but it really is still it's an incredibly unique combination, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, and it was very clear, you know, there was a lot of people volunteering in this camp with a lot of different organizations, and everyone there had, you know, a really big heart, and no doubt they wanted to help. But what I did see in some instances was there was a lack of that skill set when it came to, for example, you know, in some places, just engineering or DIY or that sort of thing. And, you know, we're talking about skills that are pretty basic to a lot of people that have spent, you know, maybe a couple of winters in a shipyard, you know, and you're familiar with power tools and, you know, how to use a grinder and that sort of thing, which, you know, are very, very valuable in these places. So that was the first thing, was kind of identifying that there was a little bit of a gap there. And at the same time, I had a lot of buddies from the yachting community messaging me being like, hey, we've seen that you're doing this, like, what's going on? Like, where are you? What are you up to? Like, you know, we're curious about getting involved in something like this as well. And the problem I had when looking for an organization to volunteer with was figuring out, okay, who do I trust in this space? And it took me a long time, a lot of Googling, a lot of phone calls, a lot of emails to find an organization that I was like, okay, I understand that if I go here, there's a good chance that my time and my skills will be used wisely. But that process was massive, and I really had to keep at it. And, you know, I think a lot of people are curious about volunteering, and when they go to look into it, you can get overwhelmed with what's on the internet. And, you know, there's so much information. It's, who do I trust? What am I going to do? And, you know, my experience was your crew would, you know, looking into it, and they were Googling volunteer Bali, and it just became too hard. And it's much easier to start Googling 5-star hotel Bali. And then that's where you go. So it's like, hey, well, I tried. Well, you know, maybe next rotation I'll get there. So, you know, part of Relief Crew is taking the barriers out of it. And, you know, we go and do the due diligence on organizations to make sure that they are who they say they are, and that, you know, the projects we support are going to be worthy of people's time. So it's eliminating those kind of factors to make it easy to get into volunteering.
I think an important point you mentioned there, Sam, is the time, because for the most part, you're dealing with active crews who are on rotation, which are time bound, right? In terms of their shore leave, effectively, it's not a sort of gap year when you can go do whatever you want, try a few things and see what sticks. It ultimately is, I know I'm going to be off the boat at this date, and I know I've got to be back on it then.
Yeah. And I think, you know, more and more crew now are getting rotations, so they have access to a lot more time off each year. And, you know, the ones that have been in the industry for a wee while and they've already used their time off to go traveling, and, you know, maybe they've made a serious dent into scratching that travel itch, and, you know, they've already been home as well, and now they're thinking, okay, well, what else do I do? What else is there out there? You know, it's making volunteering available for the people that, you know, do have access to time off and potentially don't have family at home that they need to go back to and that sort of thing.
I think that's a very important thing about the increasing rotation, right? Because that's pretty new in the industry, as I understand it, because obviously people are seeking, or say crew are seeking, greater effective work-life balance, like much of the rest of the world. It's a lifestyle, as we described before. You're around your colleagues, you're living with your colleagues in a relatively confined space for the most part, for months and months on end. Driving the sort of desire for rotation actually means that there are presumably increasingly more hands and more time available for projects like yours.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and there's only more and more boats being built each year. And, you know, as the competition for good crew increases, then, you know, boats are finding that they're having to offer this rotation. So, as you say, it's becoming the norm.
Super yachting and humanitarian work, as we alluded to earlier, may seem poles apart. What were some of the hardest aspects of you having to make that transition yourself from the travel of, say, super yachting more traditionally into the kind of sort of travel and sort of logistical organization that you're doing now? That they're also your family, your work family, but seriously, you're on those boats for a long period of time, any one stints. What were some of the tough bits about leaving?
In all honesty.
Always honesty, Sam.
I was ready to leave. I was at a point when I'd been in the industry, you know, on and off for more than 10 years, and I'd got a to a place where I was like, I'm really, really for, you know, a new challenge and to start something afresh and to have that dedicated to helping people in genuine need. You know, and there are so many similarities between these two, you know, two industries that are polar opposite ends of the spectrum. But it's crazy how much crossover there is, you know, although they might look completely different on the surface. So many of the skills that you use in one are transferable to the other. And a lot of that comes around the logistics side of things. You know, the skills that are used on boats when something goes wrong and you're at sea and you have to fix it. And, you know, ideally you would fix it with maybe your sea, but maybe you don't have that available. So you find what you can. The same thing happens in a humanitarian environment as well. You know, you're looking for a constant solution to problems and you make do with what you've got. So I think maybe in some respects, there's a little bit of a difference there in that ideally in the yachting world, you know, every fix has to be, at some point, it has to look perfect, right? You know, and you're talking about, you know, when things have to shine brightly and work essentially, you know, the need is slightly different in that humanitarian space. But, you know, to come back to your question, there is so much else that crosses over. You know, on boats, you have this camaraderie between the crew. Well, when you're on a project, you have this incredible camaraderie between the volunteers and the community that you're working alongside as well. And I think, you know, in many ways, it's more special because your common goal is, you know, to help someone in genuine need. And if you're volunteering, you're taking the money side out of it. You know, it's there's no complaining that, oh, well, you know, my buddy on the boat next door is earning 100 euros more a month kind of thing, and they get one more day off a year. Like that's completely removed. And the reason that you're in a place has nothing to do with the perks that come with a job. You know, you're purely there to assist, to help. So yeah, the camaraderie that comes with that, I think, is really cool. And then even that crosses into working alongside the communities, you know, whether it's, you know, in a village in Africa or in the mountains in Morocco or in a refugee camp. Like often what I've experienced is, you know, the language can be a barrier, but if you've got a blueprint of something that you're building or working on together, you know, like that's the language you're reading, you know, building plans, for example. And there's so much connection that can happen without words. And it's actually an amazing thing to experience as well when you're part of a community where you can't necessarily communicate with words, but you still understand that, like, okay, these guys are absolute jokers and they're clearly giving that guy over there a bit of a hard time. And it's like, you know, that's exactly what would happen on, you know, on a building site in New Zealand or anywhere else around the world. You know, like, people are the same. Yeah, those are the really special moments, I think.
It's pretty humbling actually, because I think you're right, it's almost the crude comparative between not just those two industries but all of us is that human element. We're people who many, many times over come together for a specific purpose, whether it's a formal employment purpose, whether it's to, you know, build 51 toilets in a village. It's so, so viscerally powerful, isn't it? When you scratch away all the kind of seemingly superfluous stuff on top, it's, pretty humbling. What are some of the, perhaps on that note, have there been any, I'm sure there've been many, have you any examples that you would like to share, even around any particular project or otherwise, that has had a deep impact on you personally? And I mean, perhaps in your capacity as now Relief Crew Foundation, because your initial description about, you know, taking off the summer and going volunteering with refugees was almost you testing the water very obviously, honestly and sincerely. But what about you now as a founder of this foundation? What have been some of the moments that have impacted you so far?
I mean, yeah, you're right, there's been a lot. I think one that really stands out was we were in Morocco just after there was an earthquake there, and a lot of the villages in the Atlas Mountains had been completely flattened. So people from there were living in sort of makeshift tents for the moment. Again, it came back to sanitation. You know, people were without toilets, so that project was also revolved around building toilets. And we were sort of going from village to village to figure out, okay, you know, how many people were living here? Do they actually have access to toilets? If not, okay, yep, we can build this many. And there was one hill you know, semi-mountain next to this valley where we had heard there was two villages at the top, and they had basically been cut off. You know, the road up there wasn't passable anymore, and they'd had hardly any assistance since the earthquake had happened. And the people in the valley were saying, yeah, there's people up there that, you know, they're not doing great, but you can't get up there. So, you know, don't even worry about it. And we were like, okay, well, let's go and check it out. So we walked up there, and it was about a 2-hour walk to get in there. And we got up there and figured out, okay, yep, there's a village here. And for sure, there's no access to sanitation. So let's build some things. But we had to figure out how we were going to get all the cement, the sand, timber, doors, that sort of thing up for these toilets. We ended up, like, after a load of calls, finding a digger that would transport most of it, the majority of the way up the hill. But then we had to get it into the villages. We had to work in with the locals there to use donkeys to get it the rest of the way in. And we had a couple of days where it was just like everyone was so dialed in to get what was needed into these villages. And it was massive days, but it was like, it just had to happen. And, you know, we spent a lot of time with the locals from that village, especially the ones that own the donkeys, loading these up with, you know, squat toilets and all the different things that were going in. And they would be the first people that would come and offer us tea and that sort of thing as well. I think, you know, that village in particular, many of the villages or the places that we've worked, the experience is that people will be the first to offer you a cup of tea, you know, whether that everything's been destroyed or maybe they don't have so much, they'll still be the most hospitable people on the planet. And that was certainly the experience in this case as well. So yeah, it was nice to be able to get into that village and to make it happen. And, you know, that came back to that, I think, that yachting mentality of like, let's just get it done, you know. And it was huge days, but it was like, I think crew are very good at working until they fall over, and that was kind of the case in point for this one.
That's an incredible achievement. I've sometimes maybe come close to being quite emotional on podcasts, but never this far, because it really is so, it's so raw. And I presume that you find that quite often based on the kind of communities that you're working with. And again, knowing that you've this opportunity and have created this opportunity and are promulgating this opportunity to connect other people with skills with these communities, right? I mean, you must have some times where, or maybe it's better not to, just feel the gravity of what this is you've created.
Yeah, I mean, I think that each project, there's moments where it's like, okay, yeah, this is actually pretty hectic. You know, I mean, the last one that we did in Ghana, for example, you know, the whole goal was to go and build toilets in this one village. You know, that's what we set out to do. And it was very clear from the beginning that was the project. But it wasn't until maybe day 3 or 4 where I was walking through the back of the village and actually saw one of the community members open defecating, you know, going to the toilet in a field, that it actually hit me that, like, yeah, this is what has to happen. Like, every single time you need to go to the bathroom, you need to walk out to the field and go to the toilet, you know. And that's so many things that that come with that, you know. And it was the reason we were putting in toilets was to help prevent disease, you know, to bring about some dignity, some safety, some privacy, that sort of thing. But it wasn't until I kind of saw that with my own eyes that maybe, like, it hit me hard as well. And I was like, shit, you know, that feeling when you're in bed at nighttime and you wake up and you're like, oh, I need to go to the toilet. Oh, do I need to go to the toilet? And oh, it's, you know, it's down the hallway. I can't be bothered. But, and you wrestle with this for an hour kind of thing. It's like, well, you know, imagine if you have to leave your house and go to the bathroom at night time sort of thing. So yeah, I think that there's definite moments on each project where it does hit you. And also the gravity of the situation. Like, you know, this was one village in Ghana, but in reality, 75% of Ghanaians don't have access to a toilet. So it's like, what do? You know, you're not going to be able to solve that problem for everyone. But as one of the volunteers said on that trip, Kendall, she mentioned that, you know, it doesn't have to be saving the whole world, you know, it can be making an impact on one village. And that was what was meaningful to her.
I think it sounds cliche, because I appreciate it's a well-trodden phrase or thought, is that you don't need to help everyone. You just need to help even one person, another couple of people, a small community, as you're doing. And that in itself has such power, because if all of us made one change, then the impacts are resounding, right? But I think also it's that when we're talking about people, you're also giving them the capacity to also help themselves, and also that they can help others. This isn't necessarily solving it for everybody. It's actually at the same time being able to empower other people that they could go off and do this in the future, pass on tips, have a conversation. We did it like this. I think that's the power is the networks that can be created from it too.
Absolutely. I mean, and if you kind of bring that back to, you know, this specific project, our whole goal with Relief Crew is to work alongside communities. You know, it's that whole model of flying in and being like, oh yeah, you don't have this, so we're gonna build this and enjoy it, see you later. Like that's gone. It doesn't help anyone really, other than maybe the people who think that they're helping. But with this project, the local community, you know, they were great with building, you know, that there was no question about that. But it was the plumbing side of things that they had never come across. They'd never been exposed to that. And, you know, it's not rocket science either, but unless you've been shown it or you've been exposed to it, then how would you know? So by the end of this project, we were able to step away, and it was the locals that were, you know, fully responsible for all the plumbing in the toilets. We've heard since then that, you know, the village next door has been over to be like, hey, you know, we heard something's going on over here. How do you do this? And yeah, the same thing is that they're now teaching the village next door, and on it goes.
That's so powerful. And there's a lot of important sort of takeaways from it, but it's for all of us. If you're shown what's possible, you know, I think to your point, it's not that plumbing is necessarily per se difficult, but if you've never seen something or don't know what the alternative could be or alternatives, then of course, I mean, all of us, you don't know where to go. But actually, if you can start introducing ideas and methodologies of doing stuff, then you can open all of our eyes with something, just showing what can be done.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what we're trying to do with Relief Crew as well, is just show people what opportunities are available for volunteering. You know, I think that can be something that puts people off volunteering, is that I don't know how I can help, or I don't know where my skills can be used, or I don't know what to do or where to go. And it's purely that awareness. And as you say, maybe it's not for one person, but maybe they pass that on to their friend that's showing some interest in that sort of thing before.
I think that's an interesting point, Sam, in that, you know, we talked about, like most industries, probably like most of the Western world, there's been this increase in work-life balance, or the desire for it, certainly, and also that kind of desire to be spending time in and participating in things of value, whether it's, you know, for the environment or for just service in some ways, right? And, you know, see companies organizing days where teams can go off and do stuff, you know, tidy up or plant sea grasses or help local charities, etc. Have you seen that too in yachting more specifically, that actually, particularly as further generations are coming through the industry, that there is also a greater drive or expectation or desire to be participating as an industry in things other than yachting and boating?
For sure. I mean, we've seen it, you know, just through our socials or through our website, the amount of people that have reached out to us to be like, how can we get involved? When is the next project? What can I do? I've been blown away, you know, like when we went all in with Relief Crew and set it up, you know, I had an understanding that there was a section of the industry that would be keen to do this, but I had no idea of, you know, how big that was really. Yeah, I've been blown away by the amount of support that we've had, with people just being like, let's go, get me in there.
That's incredibly, incredibly special.
And I think it goes back to, you know, like volunteering is, you know, yes, you're there to help someone else, but it feels good, like, to do something for someone else. And I think, you know, it's becoming more and more publicized now. You know, even if you hold the door open for someone that's walking out of a building behind you, you know, like, for a millisecond, it's a good feeling. And then, you know, the person who's received that, they're like, oh, hey, thanks. And then, you know, they go on about their day. And you get a bit of pep in your step as well after it. And that's what volunteering does, you know, like everyone wins, I think, when you're involved in helping out.
I think that's a really good example, because often you'll see that the person that you've held the door open for will then in turn hold it for the next person. Often by doing these kind of seemingly micro moments in life of supportive action gives license to other people to do the same, even subconsciously. You know, if you smile at someone in the street, I'm not saying smile at everybody, but there are limitations and there's, you know, healthy boundaries, let's be clear, more than anything. But often you will set the tone for that person to then go off and do the same. Like, it does instill something. The intention behind so much of what we do is very subliminal, I think, and often subconscious, but no less potent.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and there's studies on it as well. You know, Harvard did that, or are doing that 80-year study to figure out, you know, what leads to people having the happiest life. And two of the major factors were having connections with a community, like, you know, your friendship group is having strong connections there. And one of the other massive ones was helping other people.
Easy, really, isn't it? Can't be. But on that, you've obviously been exposed to a couple of different communities, right? And in that, there are different cultures too. And what are perhaps some of the most unexpected lessons that you've learned, can be grand or really small, but that you've learned from specific communities or cultures that have changed the way you think, even about the smallest of things?
I think that the generosity is generosity, resilience, vitality. You know, these are some of the massive things that have been apparent in all of the different projects that we've worked on. You know, whether that is a village in Africa where the locals are living day to day, or it's you know, a village that's been destroyed by an earthquake, or it's a community that has been forced to flee their home and leave behind jobs and you know, everything. Those are the common denominators. And in all of those places, you know, I touched on it before, like just the act of having a cup of tea, you know, that it's like we've been invited for so many cups of tea and, you know, the first people to eat at any place. And it's, you know, people that are really struggling, but they're willing to offer you, you know, the first bite at whatever's on serve, or the, you know, the first cup of tea. And it's not because there's any expectation or want or anything from that, you know, it's not, there's no motive behind it other than just human kindness. And yeah, that's really interesting because, you know, okay, I come from New Zealand and Kiwis are friendly and, you know, they'll say hello to each other when they pass one another on the beach walking the dog or whatever. But good luck finding someone that would invite a stranger into their house for a cup of tea. You know, it's not that likely compared to these different villages that we've been working in. So I don't know. It's difficult to say why or pinpoint why. I haven't dived into that yet, but that's definitely an experience.
I think there's two things, isn't there? There's the element of there's no expectation. I think in some ways, not always, but crudely, our Western cultures are quite transactional. That's not to say we're devoid of emotion or compassion or humanity at all, right? There's some exceptional examples of that too, but we're more separated from that element of community than perhaps we originally grew up in. You know, we're not living in that commune kind of setup, which we would have done hundreds of years ago. We've actually become so much more fragmented, and it's expected that you would leave home at 18 or even earlier for some, I appreciate, by accident or design. But I do think there's sort of a social cohesion element of it that is very different. Yeah, I probably wouldn't invite a stranger into my home for a cup of tea. I say that not because I'm not a magnanimous person, but rather because, you know, like we said, there's kind of safety and there is an element of trust. And I think when you're existing within a community which is perhaps more anonymous, it's the element of trust that it's kind of a different kind of bond, even if it's relative stranger, that it drives a different kind of relationship between people, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And it's amazing to be a part of that as well, to be welcomed into that kind of community.
And what are some of the opportunities that you've seen of others that have joined you, some of the crew members that have joined you, who perhaps was a complete first for them to walk into these environments? What are some of the perhaps learnings or things you've observed for those people who've done this for the first time and didn't know what to expect?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Because for a lot of people, I mean, you've already made that bridge between, you know, ultimately, I'm not saying it's luxury for crew necessarily, but from an environment which is exceptionally discerning, serving a sector, a demographic of society, which has exceptional expectations, moving into what you've been describing as a very somewhat raw, incredibly proactive, very dynamic. No one's sort of speaking the same language at times, even communicating verbally other than obviously, you know, by gesture and just by being human. Surely that has got to come tough to some people over others.
Yeah, I think there was one guy that we had on the Morocco project. It was certainly his first instance with, you know, volunteering and in a culture that was completely different to anything he'd experienced before. And I'd sort of picked up that he was a little bit nervous in the beginning with it as well, but perhaps not as nervous as he later admitted to being, you know. And from his side, he was more worried about doing something wrong, you know, like he didn't want to upset the culture or to do anything that was maybe offensive. But you know what he quickly found out, what he quickly, you know, said himself was like, you know, everyone here is just so lovely and nice that there's no worries whatsoever. And it was it was awesome to see him sink into that as well and quickly become comfortable and happy to be chilling with the people that, you know, he was working on a project with. And, you know, although that, again, the language was a complete barrier, figuring out that, you know, that that doesn't matter. And then also that transferred back to the yacht as well. So at that point, I was working on a boat and we were working together. And it was interesting to see that, you know, some of those things from Morocco returned to the boat in terms of, I think, like, yacht crew receive a lot and very fortunate in that respect. But I think, you know, if you've gone volunteering into a community that is struggling, there's no way you're going to return to the boat and complain that your favorite yogurt's not in the fridge or the right chocolate chip cookies aren't in the jar kind of thing. So this perspective is definitely something that hits hard and fast. And I think it's absolutely for the benefit.
That's a very, very important point, because we've talked so far about what can the crews or crew members be providing to communities, right, by virtue of their skills. And in turn, what are these projects or this exposure to these communities providing the crew as a collective, but also as individuals? And that's really something, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, it is easy to get wrapped up in this yachting bubble and get carried away with being surrounded by, you know, the type of environment that yachting exists in. You know, humans are very good at adapting to that environment. And it's like, okay, you know, you step foot on a boat and there's a Picasso hanging in the toilet. And the first time you see that, it's like, holy moly, okay, that's incredible. And then, you know, the second time you walk past it and it's like, oh, yeah, there's that thing. And it goes on and on and on. And the same goes for these, you know, the reverse is true. You know, you arrive in an environment which is like, you know, the polar opposite to that. And it's like, wow, okay, you know, this is crazy that humans are living in these sorts of circumstances. But also, you know, because we're good at adapting, you know, the wallpaper changes and you get on with the job. And it's like the thing that maybe shocked you on the first day, you know, you see it on the second day, but, you know, you're there to get something done. But for sure, when you return back to, you know, the life that I guess you live most days, you still bring with that sense of what, you know, what you've seen. And I think that, having your eyes opened is a great leveler. Absolutely.
What's one of the common misconceptions around humanitarian work that perhaps you want to set straight, having done it yourself now for nearly a year under your own steam?
One of the big questions we get is, will it be safe? And so there's a couple of points to that. And, you know, it's a very valid question. So what we do at Relief Crew is the due diligence on an NGO, the community that is we're there to support, and the location. So, you know, that's our biggest priority. You know, we need to make sure that the safety is, that there's no question of safety, essentially, before we start any project, you know. And we look at that, and it's only after we assess that, okay, there's no risk here, that we'll progress with, okay, let's see how this project can evolve. But I think also when people are unsure about working with a different culture or a religion, that can also create these misconceptions as well. And, you know, media is not great for that. And yeah, there's a lot of questions that come around that. And I think that it's hard to kind of convey what we touched on before, but, you know, the communities that we work with are all so warm and welcoming and, you know, just the most deserving people on the planet. And it's just something that is found out very quickly.
If a crew member was listening to us right now, which they will be, and thinking about joining you and Relief Crew Foundation on one of your projects, what would you say to them?
Do it. Just come. I think if it's one of those things, like if you've already been thinking about volunteering, or it's something that, you know, has grabbed your interest before, then that's probably for a reason. You know, there's a niche there. So to put a sailing spin on it, if you're thinking about putting a reef in the main, you know, you should probably put a reef in the main. I think it's something that you're not going to regret doing that. You know, we have a set amount of time on the planet, and I think to put aside a couple of weeks to go and help, you know, people that really deserve it is something that you're going to remember for a long, long time. And yeah, that there's so many benefits that are going to come from it on a personal level as well. So yeah, come and contact us. That's what I'd say. We can figure out how your skills will fit into one of our upcoming projects.
Well said. And finally, a message for listeners, whether it's either for seafarers or the industry, actually more broadly, to take away from this conversation. What would you say to us all?
That we do have the ability to make a meaningful change in the world and in communities that genuinely deserve it. And that goes from, helping on a community level. It goes from yacht crew being able to help on a community level to the yachting industry to be able to really get behind this as well, use their resources, their influence to also make a massive change. So it goes back to what we touched on earlier is, it doesn't have to be saving the whole world. It can be starting with one community and, together that's something that we can do.
Where can people find out about Relief Crew Foundation?
You can find out more on our Instagram account. That is probably our most up-to-date information, which is at Relief Crew Foundation, and on our website as well, www.reliefcrewfoundation.org.
Sam Stewart, founder of Relief Crew Foundation, connecting our skilled yacht crew with humanitarian and environmental projects worldwide. Thank you so much for your time.
Holly, thank you. So good to chat. And I'm looking forward to connecting more.
For more about Clean Sailors and our projects, just head to cleansailors.com. Thanks for listening and see you for the next episode.